The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Monday, January 14th, 2019. This is the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth Leibson. Our number is 602-508-0960. Okay, let me start a little startingly. It's not the usual monologue today, and it's not about things you've been reading mostly in the newspaper or seeing on TV. Here's a quote from an American. I repeat, an American. He's 25 years old. Quote, "Are you not able to use a knife against the infidels, to throw them from a building, to run them over with a car? Liberate yourself from hellfire by killing a kafir." Close quote. That means non-believer. This is an ISIS propaganda video. It is stated, imprecated, if I might, by a boy who was born with the name Zulfi Hoxha. His current name, by his choice, is Abu Hamza al-Amriki, which means the American. His parents moved here from Albania. He was educated at an Atlantic City high school, and shortly thereafter, like several dozen others, moved abroad and joined ISIS. This came to my attention over the weekend via a profile on this man in the Atlantic Monthly. I'd like to read some of it. Quote, "Hoxha is the first American Islamic State member known to behead individuals. Hoxha is now known to have become a senior commander of the Islamic State and one of the faces of the group's recruitment efforts, according to federal court records. Hoxha left the United States in 2015, April of 2015. 4 days after he left, he was in an Islamic State training camp. Within 6 months, according to multiple law enforcement officials, he was featured in the gruesome video." Let me give you some more. "Recently, some 50 Americans were arrested trying to join ISIS. As with most known cases of Americans traveling to join the Islamic State, the Internet proved a useful tool for Hoxha. While it is often tempting to assume that individuals are radicalized online through their consumption of propaganda, this is rarely the case. More commonly, the Internet allows people to make contacts with and plug themselves into pre-existing real-world recruitment and radicalization networks. In Hoxha's case, the network he found would encourage and eventually facilitate his travel to Islamic State territory." Close quote. Understand that well. Pre-existing real-world recruitment and radicalization networks. It made me think of the Rolling Stone profile of the Boston Marathon bomber brothers, also young American men, second generation, as usual, the Tsarnaev brothers. Regarding Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, one of his teachers spoke quite honestly to the Rolling Stone magazine, saying, quote, "A fair amount of his students, notably those born in other countries, believe 9/11 was an inside job. The teacher tells me he's shocked by the number of kids he knows who believe the Jews were behind 9/11. The problem with this demographic, he says, is they do not know the basic narratives of their histories, or really any narratives. They're blazed on pot and searching the Internet for any factoids that they believe fit their highly dehistoricized and decontextualized ideologies. And the adult world totally misunderstands them and dismisses them, and does so at our collective peril." Close quote. Not going to blame pot here. That's too easy. The harder thing is the not knowing of the basic narratives of their histories. These kids being highly dehistoricized and live in and without contextualized ideologies. What do they do? Say it with me. These decontextualized histories all blame America first. As Bill Bennett and I wrote in our book, The Fight of Our Lives, we have made aliens in our own countries by alienating ourselves and our children from our history and our cause. Not only do many of our children not study our history anymore, the many who do, study it as an oppressive story of misery, exploitation, and injustice. Looking for sustenance, these children are served thin gruel in our nation's classrooms. Thin gruel about their own country. Is it any wonder, then, that some poor souls, when offered a strong helping of identity and something else, of righteousness in some cause, are drawn to it? Say what you will of them, but nationalist supremacy, racial superiority, and Islamic fundamentalism are all very strong brews. They can fill a hungry and lost soul. C.S. Lewis says we laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. To more than a few, American history, our founding, the cause of the West, unpresented or weakly portrayed, can have little chance against the power and appeal of a strong, if noxious, ideology. To some souls, combine all of this with the rage that naturally follows from the catalog of the evil actions of the West, and we begin to understand root causes. And radical Islam is there, in the waiting, in the preaching, and for the taking. It is now simply time to get off our national and international couches and direct all citizens, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, to the source of a better medicine, a medicine that was once seen as strong, as curative, as worth fighting for. It is known as our founding creed. There are indeed self-evident truths and rights, among which are the equality and freedom of all humanity, women, Jews, infidels among them. And they are entitled to, nay, they are already endowed with those rights, and yet we no longer speak or teach the language of such moral absolutism, such extremism, if you will. We don't do it with any moral conviction that young children or young adults can crave. Radical Muslim leaders slake that thirst with their absolutism. That's why there is a strong Islamist appeal to the John Walker Lins and Bradley Mannings and Adam Gidons and Nidal Hassans and Faisal Shahadads and God knows how many other lost souls among us, including the one I told you about today. They follow a strong and stern teaching to a perverted end, and they have teachers that believe in that end and lead them to it. They give them a cause to live for and to die for. But who, given the sorry American the revisionists have made, who among them would sign up for or live and die for that sorry country? We have it in our power to breed heroes and statesmen, just as we have it in our power to breed terrorists and traitors. We breed both by example and instruction, and just now we need a great relearning about what we are teaching and tolerating through our national example and instruction, both in how we treat the enemy as well as in how we treat our own philosophies of statecraft and soulcraft. Our only repatriation can come once we take seriously again our self-evident truths, our political religion, in understanding our Constitution and founding as the basis of our laws. Abraham Lincoln once put it this way, as the patriots of 76 did to the support of the Declaration of Independence, so too the support of the Constitution and laws. Let every American pledge his life, his property, and his sacred honor. Let every man remember that to violate the law is to trample on the blood of his father and to tear the character of his own and his children's liberty. Let reverence for the laws be breathed by every American mother to the lisping babe that prattles on her lap. Let it be taught in schools, in seminaries, and in colleges. Let it be written in primers, spelling books, and almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpit, proclaimed in legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. And in short, let it become the political religion of the nation. And let the old and the young, the rich and the poor, the grave and the gay of all sexes and tongues and colors and conditions sacrifice unceasingly upon its altars. We've lost that teaching, that instilling of public faith in our own country and our own cause. We've replaced and indeed denigrated that extremism, if you will. Now, what Lincoln had in mind is a good deal different from today's teachings of the feckless thing we've replaced history and government with. We call it social studies. So perhaps William Butler Yeats had it right. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Is it too late to recapture the forces of composition over the forces of decomposition? Well, no soon enough. When the next act of terrorism takes place, will it be at the hands of an American we may be instructing here or in London? After all, these murderers take their instruction seriously. We may soon find out whether we will take seriously our great moral and intellectual inheritance and so determine whether we indeed have the will and ability to not only call this a war, but to win it as well. Or, in the long run, will we prove to be the authors of our own undoing? Again, Lincoln put it best. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. Thank you for letting me get that off my chest. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. Governor Doug Ducey has given his, I guess it would be fifth state of the state address. We will cover that probably a little bit more tomorrow than today as it just wrapped up. Dennis is in Phoenix. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Seth. How's it going?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, thank you. Hey, I had a couple of quick questions, kind of a lighthearted questions about the caravan. The migrant caravan.
There's a new one forming evidently out of Honduras. Is
there
that the one
is.
You mean? Yeah.
There is. Imagine
yeah.
that. No, just all of them together.
Okay.
I noticed on when they were, when the Border Patrol was lobbing tear gas over the line, I noticed a lot of the migrants had gas masks. And I've been going to Mexico my whole life, and I've never seen people with gas masks down there. I wonder where they get those.
I don't know.
Did they carry them out from Guatemala?
I don't know.
They seem awfully well prepared.
Yeah, I just don't know. Did they actually fire it over? I thought they fired it once they crossed the wall. I don't remember that they fired it over the wall. I don't know that answers your question though.
Well, I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Because obviously they were put up to it. You know, they were prepared to get on the news and cause a scene. And also, you remember there was a one girl, I think she was 24 years old, that from Honduras that climbed the wall and then had a baby on the American side? Did you hear that story?
Nope, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, she from Honduras walked to the Estados Unidos, climbed an 18-foot wall, has a baby, and if it's legal, I'd like to hire her. She's got determination.
I was just Googling it quickly, it looks like she was a little younger than you said even, but fair enough, 19.
Really?
Yeah, but yeah, same
yeah.
story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, she would put a snowflake over here to shame.
Well, yeah, I look, I'm not sure what you're driving at exactly, Dennis, but I'm not picking up the joke, but I will tell you that almost every day there was a new argument for stronger and stronger border security, and whether it has to do with, you know, being a magnet for caravans, whether it has to be do with being a magnet for people coming here for nefarious purposes, whether it has to do with staunching the flow of drugs, whether it has to do with helping out Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs, so that they can patrol, you know, 1 mile per agent rather than 4 miles per agent. Every single day, whether it has to do with violence in America, criminality in America, freeing up our prison systems, freeing up other budgetary items. I read this morning in the paper, 20%, 1 in 5 of school children being educated in the public schools in California is an illegal immigrant. Think about that when we talk about classroom size. Think about that when we talk about budgets. Every single day there is a new argument for a border wall that astounds me that Democrats like Beto O'Rourke, who I guess is probably soon going to announce for president today, called immoral in 3 different sentences. I have no idea what is immoral about it, and no one to this day can tell me what's immoral about it unless we have an obligation to, and I don't know why we would, no other country does, unless we have an obligation to lower every single barrier to entry in this country. If we did that, we would not have a country. No country would have a country. We admit about a million immigrants per year legally. We could do it for everyone who has a story about coming here legally, a lot more streamlined, a lot more sensibly, and a lot better if we had control of our border from illegal immigrants. And I will tell you this. While we are focused on this issue, we also need to focus on other internal mechanisms. We need to focus on visa overstays. We need to focus on the entirety of the problem. And I think, though the polls are not showing that the Republicans are favored right now, 53% it looks like are saying that the Republicans are to blame. I don't think that's such a big or insuperable number to overcome. I think we have the right on this argument. And I think that the more that the Democrats talk about it being immoral, the more we just need to ask why. I want to take them on their own argument. What about it is immoral? And what is the difference between a wall, a slat, and a fence to them? What is the degree of the morality that is distinct here? The truth is the Democrats are using this as a political purpose and a political wedge issue that I think is doing the real humanitarian harm. And to the degree that people are, forming a new caravan out of Honduras where people will die, where families will be separated, is in no way to me moral and is in no way to me humanitarian. And once we say that this cannot happen and this will stop, this will not happen and this will stop. We just need to own and embrace this issue. And, we can talk all day long about, whether, the Democrats are going to blink first or the Republicans are going to blink first. We can talk all day long about it. We're talking about 0.1% of our budget. We're talking about less than half of what we spend per day from the federal government. I read over the weekend that in the USA Today and in some other newspapers that this government shutdown is now beginning to show its effects. Well, you know what? I'm still not convinced of that. I have yet to, and I'll invite anyone in the audience to let me know what those effects are. I believe this is a propped up story that involves a coterie and a congeries of federal employees based out of Washington, D.C., and that any short term problem with this shutdown, whether it's a certain sector, can be well funded. And I believe that the president can well fund any series or any sectors in the government that are going to affect everything or anything from the delivery of mail to transportation security. And if the Democrats want to fight that, I say have at it. Go for it. But at this point in the game, it doesn't look like they're at all interested in a negotiation. At this point in the game, it doesn't look like they have any single argument that makes any sense to me. And finally, I'll just say this. If we're wrong, if our side is wrong, and we solidify the border, if we solidify our sovereignty, and there's no difference in illegal immigration, there is no difference in flow of drugs, there is no difference in flow of sex trafficking, you know what? We've spent $5 billion on worse things. It's called Pascal's Wager. There is no harm that can come from this, and only a big series of goods. It's time to do it. I'm Seth Liebson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. If it's 3:34, it's time for our Culture and Economy Watch with our good buddy John Dombrowski from Grand Canyon Planning. You can follow him or contact him through his website, grandcanyonplanning.com. Hi, John. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday, Seth. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm fighting off this cold that's been going around.
Uh-oh.
And it's been kind of getting me down a little bit, but I soldier on.
All right. You've got to do it. We have to keep pushing forward.
Yeah, you betcha. So I have two questions for you, John.
Shoot.
One is a down payment from last week where mm-hmm. I asked if you would let our audience know what it means when you say markets open low or lower today. When you use that construction, what does that mean? Where do they start? Why do they start lower?
Well, if you follow the market at all, if you're a an enthusiast of the market. Sometimes you may look before the market opens. You may see there's something that we call the futures, the stock futures, right? So we can tell what's going to happen when stocks open. Are they going to open higher from where the close was the prior day of trading, or are they going to open lower? And so oftentimes, based on economic news overnight or potentially some expected news that might be coming out that day, that's going to drive market prices for stocks. And so we can see what, you know, a feeling of what's going to happen at the open. So this morning, actually, stocks opened lower today. Futures were lower, and that was because of some early reports of corporate earnings. Citibank was reporting lower than expected, and that was driving stocks lower, as well as PG&E stock, if you heard of this.
Yeah,
of course.
Well, that was my second question. Mm-hmm. Had to do with utilities. Go right ahead.
Had to do with utilities, and of course, that was a drag on the markets and the indexes, so stocks were opening lower. That's what I mean by that. Does that mean stocks are going to close lower at the end of the day? No, they trade freely throughout the day. And oftentimes you'll see a reversal in trading, and you may start to see the stock market close on a high note rather than lower.
So it's,
but that's what we're talking about.
So okay, so it doesn't mean that the stocks, as I think conventional wisdom would have it, open at the same place they closed the night before because of where the futures are.
That's correct.
Perfect.
That's correct.
That is a perfect explanation. Thank you, John.
You got it.
But that PG&E story was the other one I had for you, because it seemed to me a big deal. Maybe I'm wrong. I think it's if it's not the largest, it's the second largest utility in California. They're now filing for bankruptcy.
Yes, they've.
PG&E must be Pacific Gas and Electric.
Yes.
Utilities used to be seen, I thought, as pretty safe investment bets.
Yeah, because utilities, we think of everybody's got to use it, right?
Yeah.
We all need our utilities to survive, our electric or gas or water and so forth. And oftentimes stocks like this pay a wonderful dividend. So oftentimes people will buy bonds from these utility companies. But if they're going to file bankruptcy, that's going to be a real challenge for those bondholders, right? So these are people who invested money in some type of a corporate bond, or in this case a utility bond, and it was being paid a specific interest rate back to them over a certain period of time, 20 years, whatever it might have been, at 5%. And now all of a sudden, if they file for bankruptcy, those bondholders are most likely going to lose all of the money that they invested and the income that they were expecting to receive from this as well. That's why it's important, again, folks, that you diversify a portfolio. And this is a prime example of that, because we would never think that Pacific Gas and Electric stock company would go out of business and have to file bankruptcy.
Right. You always thought, as I said, you always thought of those as strong. Heck, I think you even have utilities on the Monopoly board, the game Monopoly, don't you?
Yeah,
don't you have
right.
the water company and the electric company? I think you do.
That is correct.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Good enough, John. Good. Yep. Well, those were two perfectly wonderful answers. I mean, I love clarity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and then the other thought here too, Chris, is, I'm sorry, Chris, I'm thinking of Chris I was just talking to in my office here, Seth, is that we have to look at the market as a whole, right? So if we say the market's opening lower or utilities are suffering today because of this, this is not all utilities out there, I want folks to understand. This just happens to be one aspect, one company, right? The Pacific Gas and Electric. So if you own Duke Utilities or some other utility companies, it's not the same thing.
Right.
But it does beg to say, well, gee, if PG&E can go under, can the utility company that I own have some financial difficulty? So, again, you should certainly understand the investments that you have in your portfolio, and we're happy to do a review of any investments that you have in your portfolio, folks. No cost or obligation for that, to sit down and talk about what you're doing to generate that income in your retirement years.
And we can't understate either, I don't think, that PG&E being a uniquely California company or so heavy in California, the policies and problems of California have had an effect, including, I gather,
well,
these huge
wildfires.
Right?
That's what really did it here, right? Because they're trying to hold PG&E responsible for those wildfires, and the lawsuits are going to be in the $30+ billion range, and they don't have the money to pay that.
There it is.
And their liability coverage doesn't cover all of that. So that's the problem.
Thanks, John.
You got it. All right. Securities and advisory services offered to Client One Securities LLC, a member of FINRA SIPC, an investment advisor. Grant Canyon Planning Associates LLC and Client One Securities LLC are not affiliated. Thanks, Seth.
Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks,
John.
You
got it. Bye-bye.
602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Happy Monday and welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I am Seth, 602-508-0960. You know, it's funny, with all the advances we have made in medicine and science, there are still some things I can't get a straight answer on that you would think we would have straight answers on, simple things. So I've been laboring through this cold the past few days, and it's hopefully at its tail end here. I cannot get a straight answer on the internets as to whether or not you can exercise with a cold. Is this a good idea or bad idea? You're nodding with me, Anthony. You have the same thing, right? You have had the same problem. So interesting, because I'm, you know, trying to do my training plan for my run in May, and I don't want to interrupt it or break it, but can I or can't I? If there is a great what, exercise physiologist or something in the audience, please let me know. Do you run on a cold or not? And then there's that whole feed a fever, starve a cold. That doesn't really affect me. But what do you do? I guess the common cold is also one of those things that has never really been figured out how we can eliminate. I guess we can do certain things to help protect, but I don't get sick that often. Just every once in a while when I do, it's a doozy. Is the story of Sodom where they were looking for one honest man? I believe it was. I am in the Democratic Party looking for a few. I guess we have a few. I have now noticed at least four, maybe not much more than that, though. That would be, I'll name names. That would be Professor Jonathan Turley at GW, Alan Dershowitz, formerly of Harvard, Joe Lieberman. And I think we have to add Mark Penn now. He is a Democratic pollster. He used to work for Bill Clinton. He has a great column today up at Fox News. Isn't that interesting? The Honest Democrats can only get published in quasi or conservative websites, theoretically conservative websites these days. But Mark Penn has a great op-ed in at Fox News today explaining, I don't know if you paid attention over the weekend to this attempted expose of Donald Trump and Russia by the New York Times. I think it was a backfire. Let me take one step back before I get to it. I have noticed a new Democratic Party talking point for the last, over the last two, three, 4 weeks maybe. And it's that Donald Trump, and by the way, this is a great talking point for those who say, well, you know, I'm a conservative, I've been a conservative all my life, but, you know, Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan would have nothing to do with it. This is a big talking point in that group, too, that Donald Trump attacks the FBI. Have you seen this? Donald Trump's attacks on the FBI, something no one would ever have any truck with. He's not attacking the FBI. He is attacking rogue agents in the FBI. He is attacking rogue officials within the FBI. No one said that when a president was cleaning house in his agency that he was attacking the agency. Jimmy Carter called the CIA a national disgrace. He was talking about the leadership. He wasn't talking about the CIA as an institution in any event. The New York Times is trying to show the corruption of Donald Trump vis-a-vis Russia over the weekend because it's the story that just keeps coming back, like whack-a-mole, I suppose. And I think it ended up showing that the rogue workers at the FBI were the problem and not Donald Trump. Let me give you Mark Penn. When Donald Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, exercising the authority he had as the President of the United States, he was taking the very action he made famous in his television career, telling people they're fired. Let's review some of the actions of the FBI director. Many of these actions were clear at the time. Others we know only now. What we have learned since underscores that the president's firing of Comey was more than justified. And the actions of Comey's staff and the Department of Justice to trigger the most extensive investigation in history of a campaign, an administration, and a president appear to be wholly without justification and were based instead on politically inspired emotion and hysteria. These are the words of a Democratic pollster. James Comey initiated his relations with Trump by holding a one-on-one meeting at which he detailed the allegations of what is now known as the Steele dossier without disclosing its source. Didn't disclose the source. Almost immediately, the contents of the dossier leaked out to the press, also without the source or any verification. Comey publicly confirmed there was an investigation of the administration and yet refused to confirm that the president was not a target of the investigation, while he repeatedly told the president that was the case. We then learned through Comey's congressional testimony that he decided to take it upon himself to clear Hillary Clinton on her email controversy, and that the memo clearing her was drafted months in advance of much of the actual investigation. Once he believed the attorney general was compromised, as he testified, he should have asked for an independent counsel. Instead, he exceeded his role and authority, politicizing the FBI in the process. His testimony was enough to get Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and then Attorney General Jeff Sessions to endorse Comey's firing in writing, citing the complete lack of professionalism. Since, we have learned new information that buttresses the case for the firing. First, Comey's tweets and comments reveal that he despised Trump, and so the self-serving memos he was making and then leaking about his every contact with the president were likely part of an effort to build a case against Trump. We learned that the FBI was wiretapping a number of Trump campaign officials largely on the basis of the Steele dossier. We learned that the dossier was authored by an operative who hated Trump and paid for by the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign via hidden payments to their law firm. And we learned that Comey sent FBI agents to question General Michael Flynn about perfectly legal conversations they already had transcripts of without following White House protocol in a deliberate effort to entrap him. Did you know that, folks? Did you know they already had the transcripts of these conversations when they went to interview Michael Flynn? On top of all this, the Carter Page warrants flat out state that the FBI had long before concluded the Trump campaign was working with the Russians. Somehow, every clear security breach in the Clinton camp, like an aide's classified mail on the laptop of a sex offender or huge payments and contributions from Russian-connected sources, was no big deal, while every fourth-hand contact with someone who could possibly be linked to Russia was evidence that Donald Trump was secretly serving as a Russian agent. How utterly ridiculous. I didn't support Donald Trump, and there are lots of things he does I don't support, but the idea that he was a Manchurian candidate working for the Russians when he ran on an American First platform is patently ridiculous. What this chain of actions supports is that there is indeed a deep state, a group of unelected officials who now wield power far beyond their constitutional authority, who believe, like Comey, that they know best. In this case, it was aided by Obama administration holdovers who never accepted the outcome of the election and sought to prevent it and later reverse it. This is Democrat Mark Penn. It's an amazingly good op-ed. I want to say more about this on the other side. There was a reporter on CNN who said, can anyone name me what a president not in the grips of Russian control would do? Byron York had a great response. I'll give it to you on the other side. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. That's a great song. Always conjures up my one of my best friends. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. So on CNN, you've heard a lot of renewed talk of Donald Trump being the Manchurian candidate, right? Because he was in the grips of, under the control of, or is under the control of the Russian government or Russian influence. A CNN contributor, Juliet Kayyem, idiot, asked if a president compromised by the Russian government would act any differently than Donald Trump has. In other words, he's still acting or is acting as if he were under control of the Russian government. Byron York had a great response, and I hope you know how much I respect Byron, but it was really great. He said, can I give 8 examples? Would that be enough? 1, would a president compromised by the Russians keep in place sanctions and impose new ones against Russia? 2, would a president compromised by the Russians approve the sale of lethal weapons to the Ukraine? 3, would a president compromised by the Russians move to withdraw from the INF treaty after starting R&D on INF noncompliant missiles? 4, would a president compromised by the Russians launch a ferocious attack that killed hundreds of Russian fighters in Syria? 5, would a president compromised by the Russians seek to add low-yield nuclear weapons to the U.S. arsenal? 6, Would a president compromised by the Russians throw Russian diplomats out of the United States? 7. Would a president compromised by the Russians urge Germany to be less reliant on Russian natural gas? 8. Would a president compromised by the Russians increase U.S. military spending and presence in Europe and push NATO to do more? Great, great points, Byron. Well done. If you are compromised by the Russians, Donald Trump is not how you behave. You would want your money back. There's a story that my buddy Jim, my GM, sent to me that I don't think is going to make most of the news. It was in the radio trades. And I got to tell you about it when we come back on the other side of the hour. Let me see if I can get Stephen in real quick before we do that, though. Hi, Stephen in Glendale. Welcome.
Hi, Seth.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. It's a very interesting discussion this afternoon. So regarding the Manchurian candidate, one thing has never been adequately explained, and that was Bill Clinton's disappearance for almost 2 years while he was a Rhodes Scholar. He was in Europe, and he simply went off the radar, and I don't think that the federal government, when they were vetting him, was ever able to adequately explain his disappearance.
That's interesting, Stephen. I don't know that history, but I'll look it up. I don't know what vetting they could give him, though. Why would they? I don't understand why he would be vetted. If you're the president doesn't get vetted in that sense, I don't think, because of the election and the constitutionality of his candidacy. But I simply don't know that history, so I will look at it. I certainly will tell you the Chinese had more influence in the 96 re-election of Clinton and Gore than anything the Russians had involving 2016, and that didn't get the attention it should have. I'm Seth. We'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.